Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and on this edition, I meet the two stars of Mike Leigh's Happy-Go-Lucky, Sally Hawkins and her driving instructor, Eddie Marson. I also catch up with the writer and director of tar black comedy In Bruges, Martin McDonagh, and I cast critical eyes over the latest releases in your cinemas. So first up, let's catch up on some of those reviews. Joining me is Zan Brooks, editor of The Guardian Film Online. And this week, we'll be looking at George Clooney's screwball comedy Leatherheads, Mike Leigh's latest film Happy-Go-Lucky, Daniel Craig in Flashbacks of a Fool, and the Irish hitman comedy In Bruges. So, Zan, lots to get through. Let's start with Leatherheads. Not the greatest set of reviews last week for Gorgeous George on this one. Was the critical consensus right?
I think there's a little bit harsh on Gorgeous
George. Oh, that's because you spent some time with his gaze.
I got won over by Gorgeous George. So Leatherheads, I think, is the film of the year. And he's a dreamboat. I think he actually probably caught people a little bit flat-footed with this. It's his third film as a director. It comes after Good Night and Good Luck, which obviously was a very kind of high-minded, rigorous, art house sort of black-and-white drama.
I like that one, did you?
I like that a lot, but this is very, very different. This is like a kind of self-conscious homage to the sort of screwball comedies of Preston Sturges or Howard Hawks. It's set in the 1920s. It's got a lot of kind of firecracker, you know, back and forth dialogue. It's incredibly light. It's very throwaway. And yet it's kind of genial. It's harmless. It's nice.
Yeah, people were a bit harsh because the gravitas that you expect from George with his kind of I'm saving the world, I'm meeting Gordon Brown, but I'm also charming the crowds and on the red carpet. I'm doing Darfur and I'm also doing Hollywood. Can he balance that mix of kind of the heavy stuff and then kind of go away and do a kind of Blumanji style comedy?
Well, he always says that he can. And he always says that what he does is he goes and makes a sort of Ocean's 13 for the money and then takes that money and makes a Good Night and Good Luck for the love. This is a weird one because I don't know where it falls. It's a small film. It's his film. He co-wrote it. Apparently he directed it. And yet it's not an ambitious, edgy project at all. It's a sort of crowd-pleasing, feel-good romp.
Well, yeah, you might say that bringing back the screwball comedy for a generation that don't know Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell or Claudette Colbert, that's a bit of a risk because, I mean, audiences don't know screwball comedies. If you look at those screwballs now, I mean, following that dialogue just for kind of the gnat's attention span of the modern youth would be very difficult. It's kind of literate, it's kind of witty. Can we kind of survive that? Do you want to see George doing that?
I think people want to see George reading the telephone directory. That's George for you. I think possibly there is a bit of a leap of faith in the style of this film. The other leap of faith that certainly British audiences have to make is that it's a film about American football. Mm. It means nothing to most people. And the ending of this film has this incredibly complicated play in American football that ends up winning the game in the last-ditch moment. That I was watching, I was thinking, I really have no idea what's going on here.
No,
at all.
I also was, by that time, Zan, I had to say, I didn't really care who won the game. It was just suddenly they were like, oh, he's going to have to play by the rules. And I was like, but it hadn't been set up as a particularly dirty outfit. They weren't exactly the mean machine. Mm. So I kind of got lost in it. I really admire what they were trying to do, him and Rene, and trying to backwards and
they were good. They were good. And if there are two actors who can kind of adapt to that style, it's those two. And I thought they cope very well with it.
What's your name?
I'm Dodge. Dodge Connolly of Duluth, Minnesota.
Lexi Littleton, Champaign, Illinois.
Hey, Lexi. What are you doing for dinner?
You're a lot of fun, Mr. Connolly. And I'm sorry I'm not going to get to know you better, but you should leave before my fiancé gets here. He's kind of big.
I can handle myself.
No, really, Mr. Connolly.
Mr. Connolly is buried next to my mother. I'm Dodge.
Dodge, it'd be better if you go.
Better for whom?
Don't get familiar, Mr. Connolly. Just because we had a laugh doesn't mean you know me.
My apologies.
Apology accepted.
But I do know you.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
It certainly looked very good.
It looked great.
The colours, the sepia tones.
It's a harmless film. It might be a faint disappointment, but it's a nice enough film. And if you don't see it on the big screen, it's one of those films that you'll kind of catch on DVD or on TV and think, that's not too bad.
And what was meeting him like?
He's such a pro, isn't he? He's very, very friendly. There's a lot of the kind of politician's handshake and things like that, but he doesn't give a lot away.
No, but did he shake your hand beautifully? Did he kind of
he
smile?
Does the Bill Clinton
I saw the
thing
footage
with
he looked like you were his best friend.
Yeah, well, and then as soon as it was over, he hasn't rung, he hasn't called, nothing.
George Clooney in Leatherheads there, and Zan slightly disappointed, I feel. Always a letdown. Zan, let's move on to, I suppose, one of the shining lights of Hollywood, to one of the shining lights of the British film industry over the last, well, 20 or so years. Mike Lee is back with a comedy called Happy-Go-Lucky, hyphenated throughout. This is a sunnier film than his last, Vera Drake, and in fact the one before that, All or Nothing. Did it tickle your fancy, sweetheart?
It did up to a point. Mike Lee's films always do up to a point, or there's a point where I always have this sort of tension with them, like, this is so annoying, this is so annoying. Actually, no, it's brilliant.
Mm.
And you kind of go either way with them. This I did like. It's jaunty, it's broad. It's perhaps a little too jaunty, perhaps a little too broad.
But aren't all his characters just, when you first see them, you think, nobody talks like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like that. Exactly. This stars sort of Sally Hawkins as an everyday North London school teacher, of the sort of everyday North London school teacher that surely doesn't exist. It's set in a North London that presumably hasn't really existed since the 1970s, where everyone's a kind of lover duck cockney. And it's bizarre. It's as bizarre in its way as EastEnders is as a portrait of the authentic East End. These films, for all his kind of reputation as one of the kind of most authentic, gritty directors in British cinema, he's as much away of the fairies as kind of Ridley Scott or someone like that now. And yet it kind of works. It's a sort of fantasy world that he creates, but within that it has a kind of odd consistency, and it takes you in and wins you over.
I was compiling a sort of list of clips last week for my interview with Mike Lee, which took up this spot here exclusively last week. And the more I looked at the clips of the old stuff, the more I realised that these people were like my family. These people were like friends to me. Aubrey from Life is Sweet. Even Alison Steadman's Abigail's Party. They are gross caricatures at the time. But over the when the period dampens down, you find them all sort of kind of like blending with the decor of the 80s or the 90s. And I think Sally Hawkins has done another one.
And there's a great warmth to them. I mean, yes, they're overbroad. Yes, they're verging on stereotypes. But there's this, incredible kind of warmth and heart and passion that even though at the time you might kind of be slightly embarrassed by them and slightly recoil from them, you find yourself thinking very affectionately of them afterwards.
I haven't even started yet.
I don't care. I've stopped. Now, you tell me why I've stopped.
Got a headache?
No, yes, I have got a headache. And you tell me why I've got a headache.
I don't know. Time of the month? Oh, give me a clue.
Well, think. Top to toe. Top to toe. Boots, Poppy.
Oh,
boots.
Here we go.
Every week I ask you, please wear appropriate footwear.
Yeah.
And every week you insist on wearing those stupid boots.
Yeah, sorry about that.
You know what this is? This is vanity before safety.
All right.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Jones. I'm sorry. Poppy killed your child, but don't worry. She looked really cool in her sexy, seductive boots.
Hmm. Am I keeping you awake at night school?
No.
Are you sure about that?
I thought this was actually a bit of a challenge, in the way that Naked's a challenge to your kind of, whether you can kind of survive the kind of torridness of the night streets in Soho. This is a sort of challenge, is whether you can bear someone as optimistic and completely sunny as Sally Hawkins in this.
Yes, it's possibly laid on a little too thick, and yet she is brilliant. She's been one of the kind of, slightly supporting people in the Mike Lee stable for a while, and here she gets her kind of moment in the sun, and it is a great performance. If he'd chosen somebody else, I think that the whole film would have been just too winsome for words and it would have all fallen apart. She kind of holds it together. And Eddie Marsan, as this sort of coiled racist driving instructor, is also superb. And again, he was in Vera Drake too. They both had sort of smaller roles in that. They've kind of graduated now.
Will we hear a bit from Sally and Eddie a bit later? They do make a strange couple indeed. A great driving movie, I thought. I mean, I know you said that North London kind of doesn't exist, but a lot of those streets are very familiar to me. I used to go to, when I used to go to Arsenal football stadium, those are the shortcuts I used to take around Florence Road and Victoria. So I was amazed to actually sort of see them given their time in film. They're the least glamorous streets in the world, I think.
I love those films that kind of take you around a London that you know and is recognisable. There are too few of those. It's all kind of Notting Hill and things like that, where everyone's got an office in the Good. And you think that's not really London.
Exactly, but traffic jams on the Holloway Road and going in the bus lane, that's my life. So that's Mike Lee's Happy-Go-Lucky. Let's stay in Britain, Zan, for Flashbacks of a Fool, which finds Daniel Craig trading on his Bond clout and persona, both as producer and an actor. How does he do this?
Well, it's a key thing. He's obviously between Bond missions, so he's decided to help out a friend. The friend is a guy called Bailey Walsh, who's making... Is it Bailey Walsh Billy?
It's Bailey Walsh.
Bailey Walsh.
Spelled Billy.
Okay.
Billy with an A.
Who's making his feature debut. And it's obviously a sort of labour of love project. And as with most Labour of Love projects, it's slightly flawed and a bit of a mess.
let's fill in with a bit of a plot. Daniel Craig plays a sort of washed up, slightly washed up Hollywood megastar, I think.
Yes, he's a Hollywood megastar kind of wasting away on the West Coast, who hears that his childhood chum from the South Coast of England has just died, so comes back to attend the funeral. Then there's a sort of the flashback comes in, where Daniel Craig is played by the young Harry Eden. I couldn't quite work out the chronology of this. This is set in the present day, and yet Daniel Craig is supposed to be a kind of 17-year-old in early 70s Britain.
Yeah, I was doing maths.
Presumably make him about 10 years older than he is.
All the way through this, I was saying, what, that Roxy music, that's 1975. Yeah. This is 1972. Then I read somewhere that this was 1972, which would make Daniel in the modern era about 50, which he doesn't look at all. So I couldn't work it out at all.
It's a very odd film. It's a really strange film. And it's a mess, but it's kind of a weirdly fascinating mess. Some messes are just dull. But this has this sort of slightly kind of languorous, stupefied, wasted, woozy kind of quality to it. It's a bit like The Cement Garden at times, and it's sort of portrait of adolescence in this sort of simmering, small-town, coastal kind of Britain in the 1970s. And yet it also has like a lot of cliches, and at times it's almost like a male version of Beaches, you know, the sort of the Bette Midler. I thought Daniel Craig was going to sing Wind Beneath My Wings at one stage.
I'd have killed for that. because it has got Olivia Williams as the mum, and it's got Helen McCrory as
it's
a kind
great
of
cast.
Batty
got,
sort of maybe lesbian aunt, as sort of these eccentric characters that populate, and a great cast, as you say. And then Amelia Fox turns up as a coke dealer. That's a good bit of casting.
Yeah.
Would never have thought of that. And who else is that? Claire Forlani. Keely Hawes, yeah, she's rather good, I thought, at the end. But very small amount of British cast all coming in together. I didn't know if this was about memory in a way. As you say, it's got that hazy, woozy quality, which I thought might be about
Well, there's also, without giving too much away, there's a key scene in which Daniel Craig is kind of floating in the sea, and you think, is this going to be like a Sunset Boulevard reminiscence from a dead man? Because it has that slight kind of dreamlike, warped quality. And yet I'm not sure quite how intentional that was.
Yeah, I did like the start where it obviously plays on his Bond persona. There he is naked for all the ladies in the house.
Yes, but did you notice that his modesty is shielded behind a series of kind of draped sheets and doors? It's a bit like Austin Powers at the start of The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Well, you can't see his gold member at the moment. Otherwise, it would be like a quantum of solace indeed, perhaps, for Mr. Craig.
For the fan base.
I think there was a lot of ambition in this film. It was almost a good idea. I didn't think it was quite good enough to carry off what it was supposed to be doing, or what I wanted it to do.
It's kind of all over the place.
I did think that the Bowie and the Roxy Music tracks were very well used.
There is one great set piece in it, in which the young Daniel Craig character has a date with the kind of the cute girl from school. And they go back to her house and they act out this Roxy Music track. And it's everything that you feel the film is trying to be. It's this sort of sensual, woozy, kind of passionate sort of moment. And that's great. And the rest of it doesn't
reach those points. It should pile on sales of early Roxy Music.
Absolutely.
It is one of the great scenes of the year. Felicity Jones and Harry Eden together. Do check that one out if you must. Right, staying sort of British, sort of Irish, but going to Belgium in Bruges. It sounds like a sort of sexual life of the Belgians. Of course it isn't, is it, Zan?
It's not. It's a fish-out-of-water hitman black comedy. And, you know, I was really predisposed to dislike this
because the poster looks stupid.
Of fish out of water hitman black comedies. There was one a couple of weeks ago called The Baker, which was terrible, and I really thought, oh my god, the last thing I need is another of these things. This is actually very good. It's by Martin McDonagh, who's the well-known young playwright. It's his writing, directing, filmmaking debut. And so it's very sharp, it's very smart, and it has a great performance from Colin Farrell, who kind of has slightly blotted his copybook in recent years, but is kind of right back on form here. Him and Brendan Gleeson play a pair of Irish hitmen who are kind of ordered to lay low in Bruges.
This is the life.
We're not staying here getting pissed. We are quietly sightseeing, like he says, and awaiting his call to see what we do next.
This is my vote on what we should do. We give it another day, 2 days max. And we check the papers again, and if there's still nothing in them, we phone him and say, Harry, thank you for the trip to Bruges. It's been very nice, all the old buildings and that, but we're coming back to London now and hide out in a proper country where it isn't all just chocolates.
My vote would be, we quietly sightsee, like he says, and await his call to see what we do next.
I was also very surprised. I thought the poster looked awful. I thought, oh no, not more sort of British gangster kind of thing. Mm. But the wit and the fizz and the sort of speed of the dialogue and the delivery and the direction, I thought, kept it all going really well.
And the kind of brooding intensity of it as well. It has a sort of, it has a proper kind of dark vein running through
it. Has
it.
A religious vein going through it as well, let's face it. There's kind of, you know...
a lot of Catholic guilt
Catholic
in here.
Catholic guilt going on here and redemption. So it's, in a way that Scorsese, I think, would have approved.
Yeah.
And there's also kind of classical painting referred to Hieronymus Bosch, and of course Nick Rogue's Don't Look Now is referred to kind of overtly. I thought it was all very well, kind of betrays a very kind of cinematic mind.
Absolutely, and a pair of terrific performances. Brendan Gleeson is reliably great.
I love him.
And it reminds me of what a good actor Colin Farrell can be. I remember seeing him years ago in that strange Joel Schumacher film, Tigerland, and thinking, this guy really has something. He's fantastic in this.
And he followed that with that very decent Irish film with about five different things. Intersection?
Oh, yes, that's right.
When Shirley Henderson's got the moustache. And then since then, he's been...
Since then, he became basically kind of tabloid fodder celebrity and went on to make things like sort of Oliver Stone's Alexander and things like that. And so really kind of fell off the pace. And he's obviously good in small, edgy, actor-led productions, of which this is one, and he's on top form here.
In a way, he trades all that percentage as well, because he plays a sort of man that you hate because he's a hitman, but he's also got this kind of bit of redemption going on, so you end up liking him. So
yeah,
you have
it's
to like
a classic
this.
Kind of yeah, a classic intense anti-hero.
So we shall hear from Martin, as I say, next. Zan, thank you very much for rounding up all those things. If you have to see one movie this week, Zan, which would you go and see?
I'd go for In Bruges.
There you have it. Zan Brooks says In Bruges, and I, do you know what? I'm going to add my thumbs up to that. Mike Leigh's comedy, Happy Go Lucky, provided last week's big interview for us on Film Weekly, as you've heard already. This week, I thought I'd catch up with its two main stars. Sally Hawkins won Best Actress at Berlin for her part as Poppy, the chirpy North London primary school teacher, herself receiving lessons in flamenco, driving, and life itself. This is indeed her breakthrough year, with an upcoming appearance in Woody Allen's Cassandra's Dream, opposite Colin Farrell, in fact. While Eddie Marson has been stealing films for a while now, with parts in British comedy 66, Vera Drake for Mike Leigh, as well as working with Terrence Malick in The New World and Martin Scorsese in Gangs of New York. I mirror, signalled and manoeuvred myself to meet them.
Right, you see three mirrors, your two side view mirrors and your rear view mirror.
Yeah.
They make a golden triangle.
Oh, is that like the pubic triangle?
It's a pyramid, and at the top of the pyramid you see the all-seeing eye, En-Ra-Ha. Can you repeat that, please? En-Ra-Ha.
Are you talking about the eye of Lucifer?
No.
Because I don't know if I want to look in there, thank you very much.
It's not Lucifer. There are two fallen angels before Lucifer. There is En-Ra-Ha, Raziel, and Lucifer.
I'm sorry, I don't have them in my phone.
Well, bear with me.
Is there? Where is he?
Bear with me.
Oh, I can't see it.
It's a teaching tool.
Oh, is it?
Let me explain to you something about teaching, Poppy.
Go on in.
The teacher's job is to bring out good habits in the pupil and to get rid of bad habits. He does that through frequent repetitive thinking. And he does that by creating clear and distinct images that are easy for the pupil to retain.
Oh, does he now?
Yes.
Don't worry, it's burnt in there. It's burnt in there.
You see, you remember. You will remember En-Ra-Ha to the day you die, and I would have done my job.
But why don't you have something nice up there, like a giant strawberry or something?
Because it works. Believe you me, it works. Oh.
Well, how exciting to be with the stars of Happy Go Lucky.
Where?
Yeah, where are they? They're hiding. Sally Hawkins, Best Actress, Berlin.
Oh, no.
That is amazing.
It's lovely, isn't it? Oh, it's great. Yeah, no, I haven't really got over that or come down from the cloud.
I guess you never know when you're doing a performance that it's gonna what's gonna happen to it.
Oh god, no. With Mike, you never know. You never really know if you're gonna end up in it. Actually, that's how he works.
Because you've been through that before.
Yeah. You sort of he works so organically, and it's you don't have a script and you don't have a character, and so. From day one, you have no idea where it will end up. And I think we were quite lucky with this one. Well, I was.
You were. Well, and Eddie Marson, you're here too. The driving instructor, we should call you.
Yes.
He was a scary individual that you've dreamed up there. Where did he come from?
When you do Mike's films, you start off with a list of people, and you have he's the essence of about three or four people, but... I mean, ultimately, it must come from you, really.
Yeah.
You know, just as Sally's character comes from Sally, I think Scott must come from me. my wife watched the film. She said, now at last they know what it's like to be living with you.
Did you really?
Yeah.
You've had a driving instructor, I presume, at one point.
I have, yeah, I did. I had a driver. My dad was my first driving instructor, and he used to drive me. He had this big Jag, and he used to drive me around the streets of Bethnal Green, and we had to go around slowly so that everyone could see the Jag. So he taught me how to pose in a car, but he didn't teach me how to drive.
So let's get this right. You were, let's say you were improvised, not obviously the finished product we know might leave. It's not improvised. We know that at the end
of it
it's...
Some of it was. One of them, I won't tell you which one, but one of them was completely improvised.
Yeah.
So you're improvising and concentrating on driving?
Yes.
is dangerous.
And learning how to drive.
This is not in the highway code.
With no. Dick Pope hanging out the back of an estate car on the Holloway Road in front of you.
Going at 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Down the wrong side of the road.
But the interesting thing is they devised these lipstick cameras. So with the cameras in the car, there was four lipstick cameras which shot us, which meant we weren't on a low loader. And so a lot of the dynamics between the two characters were expressed through the car. Because when you have an argument in a car, the argument is expressed through your driving. Mm. So the film would have been stifled if we hadn't have had these lipstick cameras.
Yes.
And did you have any accidents?
Yes.
Just a few, yeah. Yes, we did.
We did. Some bloke smashed into us. It was his fault. Some bloke smashed into us.
It wasn't his fault.
It was his fault. He came around that corner and
he said
he said his carpet slipped, didn't it? Remember?
Oh, yes, his carpet.
His carpet slipped and he couldn't put his foot on the brake and he went into us.
And it decked out with the MFI.
Yeah.
And so where was Mike during all of this?
Sleep.
He was in the back. He was in the boot.
Was in the boot. With his having trouble with his coccyx, I think,
at
the time.
I think he was, yeah.
So, I mean, it is fascinating. Every time Mike Leake's film comes out, we talk to the lead characters and the actors, and they're kept in ignorance. Just people every time kind of go, but how? I don't understand how that can... How ignorant you can be. What, you do all this work, 6 months' work, and you even laid down from the script, you know, you've even got a script at the end of it, haven't you? For each shooting day, at least.
Yes, you know what you're going to be shooting. There's nothing written down, but you know what you're going to be shooting.
Right. Yeah. And you just don't know what the film's going to be?
No, I have no idea.
But you know that your scenes are going to be in it, or you hope they are.
Well, when you shoot it, you know it will be in it.
But how much other stuff is there, Sally? I mean, I suppose because your scenes are your scenes. You only appear with Sally, don't you, Eddie? But I mean, so is there loads of other stuff with the friends and with the sister and all that you think that could be the main thrust?
Oh, yes. I mean, I had more of an idea. You sort of think, but I still didn't know sort of what angle or what eyes Mike was seeing it through. You're concentrating on what you're doing and being in your character's world, and that's your focus, really. But Mike, it could have been any film. I mean, it could have been a tragedy.
Sally Hawkins and Eddie Marson there, stars of Happy Go Lucky. But back to our film of the week that Zan and I chose. It's In Bruges by the Academy Award-winning writer-director Martin McDonagh, who takes audiences on a killingly funny trip to Belgium. Martin is making his directorial debut with a feature film here after successful runs on Broadway and the West End, including two Olivier Awards for The Lieutenant of Inishmore and The Pillow Man. Here he makes his big screen debut after winning an Oscar for Six Shooter, his short with Brendan Gleeson. I caught up with Martin and congratulated him on the success of In Bruges being Film Weekly's Film of the Week. Martin, congratulations on In Bruges. I was delighted by it. I laughed. I was given pause for thought. I thought it was a really fine film, major film debut. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks very much, Jason. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's quite good news, really, isn't it? I mean, I saw a couple of your plays on the stage, and what I found was most remarkable was that you managed to kind of continue that style and that energy. Is that difficult to make the transition?
I don't know. I think that's the kind of sensibility I've got about story and about character. So I guess that transfers pretty easily from one to the other. But I hadn't directed anything on stage before. So, but I'd always been involved in rehearsals and talking to the actors. And
so you've never actually directed one of your plays? That completely surprises me because you know they've got the same kind of the pitter and the patter. They kind of work very well.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the dialogue's pretty similar from the plays to the films. I'd always been in the rehearsal room, so I'd always be there giving my opinion, etc. But no, never actually directed one. But I think pretty much everything that came on stage in London and went to New York, there wasn't anything I disagreed with about the directing of them. So I think the sensibility does come across.
Is it nice to get? It must be nice to get hold of it. Finally, your words, your actors, your direction, and kind of get everything on screen. I mean, that's quite a lot of control, actually. Because normally in theatre you get more control than you do in movies, and here you've obviously kind of had control freak control.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing with me was to be in a position that I wouldn't have to take any shit from anybody, really, producers or money people. So basically, that was about waiting to be in that position, you know. So, you know, I probably had options to do something in film maybe 7 or 8 years ago when the plays were going well. But I probably wouldn't have had as much control then as I did now, you know. So it was just about waiting.
Do you think a little Oscar, the Oscar for Six Shooter, does that help?
I think it didn't hurt, but I was glad that the deal for this was done actually before that happened. And there were like 2 or 3 film companies that wanted to do it. So that gives you power when there's a few people at the table who want to go with you.
I was so pleased to see that you took Brendan Gleeson, who I've long admired as just a fantastic screen actor. I loved his work in Paddy Brennan's I Went Down.
Yeah, that's one of the first things I saw him in a big film, I think. Yeah, he's brilliant. And I'd actually worked with his son on stage too a few years ago. He was in The Lieutenant of Inishmore.
I mean, you also had Colin Farrell, of course, and Ralph Fiennes. I always didn't want to sort of say that you've got Ralph Fiennes in there because he comes as such a surprise in the film. You can sort of hear his voice first, but I suppose it's on the poster, so everyone knows. But I actually forgot that he was in it. And when you're trying to work out who is that voice, I know that voice. And then he appears, kind of does a Ben Kingsley and Sexy Bees kind of thing. I thought it was a great bit of casting.
Yeah, good. No, that I kind of wanted to cast against type a little bit in that, and yeah, also not to have the credits at the start. So a few people have said that actually, that they forgot that he was in it or didn't recognise the voice, which is good, because hopefully it should be a little bit of a surprise when he pops up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, did he enjoy it? Did he kind of say, "Yeah, I'd love to play it like this"? Or did you work on the voice together? Or did, because on the script you can't really tell that he's, you know, that got that, well, similar Cockney kind of twang to that Ben Kingsley kind of brought to Sexy Beast. And it's the, you know, the two classical actors that are, you know, who are more, I suppose, known for sonorous voices, doing their gangster voice here.
Yeah, no, it was interesting to you know, when I approached Rafe, I sent him the script. He just said he's not really offered that kind of part ever, really, you know, both comedy and working class and gangster types.
Let's just talk about Colin Farrell as well, because that's a great bit of casting. Great eyebrows he's got. You make much of them.
Well, I didn't really do anything with his eyebrows. Now, he's brilliant. I think he hasn't really been, you know, appreciated for his acting talents for a while. Maybe he's made some choices that, you know, didn't suit his talent so well. But I think it's brilliant. I think he shows off brilliant comedic talent, but a real sadness too. I think hopefully the sadness and the pathos really comes across.
Do you think that the film confuses people? I mean, it's in Bruges, which is in Belgium, of course. I don't know where you got the idea to go to Bruges from.
Just being there and just seeing how cinematic the place was and how unused on film it had been.
Yeah, because you actually say something in the dialogue about it, saying it's never been put on film before, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a genius trick, and it does work absolutely wonderfully. What comes first, Martin, when you're writing? Are you a theme kind of person, or are you a character person with the dialogue?
More character and dialogue, actually. For this, it was just, I had the idea of these two guys who are stuck in this town who just didn't want to be there. That was the first thing, and then I thought, why would two people, who one of whom hates it, one of whom really likes it, why would they have to be there for a period of time? And that's when the whole idea of them being hitmen kind of kicked in. But that only came after the characters were there, really.
Well, obviously, everyone knew, anyone who'd seen your plays, they knew that you could do dialogue and that it could fizz so well and that it would be funny and dark, and it is. But what I was so pleased to see was that you've got great, obviously, sense of pacing for film and a sense of pacing your cameras as well. I mean, I think it kind of masterfully done. I was really, really pleased for you.
Thanks. I mean, that was one of the main things, is that I didn't want to make something that looked like a playwright's film. You know, I didn't want something very stagey and that was just sort of talking heads, you know. I wanted something to be as, because my first love was always film, so I wanted to try and attempt something that was as visual as possible.
Are you allowed to say, won't the playwriting and the theatrical community round on you for kind of selling out and leaving them to go to film?
No, they know their place.
Martin McDonagh on In Bruges there. Well, that is all we've got time for this week on Film Weekly. The show was produced by Paul Noble. I've been Jason Solomons, and until next week, we wish you all happy viewing.